Good morning, everyone. I think where the worship time has led us is actually the perfect place for where I want to try to color something in further. I think the reality is that a lot of us go through just general challenges, suffering in life, and often don't really know why. We don't have the bigger picture. We don't see the reason. And usually with these times, God is busy forming something within us. And it's just that bigness of God to be able to do, to form something in us that I think we sometimes just don't look at as fully. So I want to kind of start with this question. It's just, how big is your God? Just for a moment, think about God. Let thoughts of God fill your mind. We've been having some good worship and some good just general time of reflection and words. But just fill your mind with thoughts of God. How big is your God? Some of you might have heard me tell this story before, but in a visit to Jerusalem a few years ago, there was this Jewish man who made this comment. He said, "You know, the problem with you Christians is that you worship a God that is 6 foot tall and looks like a man and has long hair. We as the Jews, we worship a God that cannot be measured, that cannot be contained, that created everything." And in some sense, he's wrong, because we do worship the same God. Our God is the one who is immeasurable and cannot be contained and created everything. But there is also truth in it, that often when we think about God, when we allow thoughts of God to fill our minds, we think about this 33-year period when God humbled himself, became a man, and looked like us. But Jesus existed for eternity. He is the Alpha and the Omega. He's the beginning and the end. He created everything. When John saw him in Revelation, there was fire in his eyes, sword coming out of his mouth, and he fell as one dead before him. The reality is that God is really, really big, really, really powerful, and that's really not doing him justice. He's much greater than we can ever imagine or think. So if I was to ask you again, just how big is your God? Does your God have absolute power and authority over every situation, over everything in creation? Or is he just a little bit far off, indifferent, really doesn't care, or is not capable of doing anything? And I want to kind of just put this word in your mind. It's a word that theologians use to try to get at what I'm trying to talk about. It's the word sovereignty of God. So don't get too stuck up on the word, it's just terminology. But what we mean when we speak about God's sovereignty is we say that he is the supreme ruler over all of creation. He has absolute authority and power over everything. It means that nothing happens outside of his knowledge or control. Just for a moment, think of your situation and be aware that nothing happens outside of his knowledge or control. There's this other part of it, which is that God is completely free to do whatever he wills. So we are not completely free. We are limited. Whatever comes into my mind, I cannot make happen. God is not like that. Whatever he wants to do, whenever he wants to do it, he is capable of doing that. And he doesn't need to ask anyone's permission. And there is nothing that limits him to be able to do what he wants to do. He is ultimately supreme over everything. He holds also the ultimate authority over all kings and rulers and nations and nature and just every aspect of life. There is no king that can do something that God did not allow that king to do. There is no authority that can do anything with God allowing that thing to happen. And that is, I think, where the offensive part comes in. It doesn't mean that God, when we say God is sovereign, doesn't mean that he is micromanaging or causing every action directly. It also doesn't mean that he is causing the evil in the world, but it does mean that he permits it. It does mean that he permits everything that happens, but within boundaries, within the boundary of his wise and good purposes. And that is the part that I think we find offensive. It's like we look at God and we say, God, look at all of the suffering. Look at how people are just killing each other. Look at just my life is falling apart. Like, how can this be your wise and good purposes? There's a bigger picture that we are missing in this. And I must admit that this reality that God is all-powerful and controls everything, yet there is so much suffering, is a profound mystery. And I'm not claiming that I've got the full understanding or view of this thing, but I'm going to try to unpack something about this for us today, because I think in just seeing something of his nature through playing out throughout the Bible, but also just in our lives, we can actually trust him a little bit more. There was this way that someone once helped me to understand this better. And the person was saying that if I was God and I was all powerful and all loving, then there would be no suffering in the world whatsoever. Because I'm loving, I don't want suffering, so I'm just going to, with all my all might, just cause all the suffering to disappear. But then the person said, if I was God and I was all powerful and all loving and all wise, I would not change anything. And it's that wisdom of God that we struggle with. We can start to see this picture a little bit once we step out of our just present situation and just look from the perspective of eternity. Then we start to see this picture that God is painting throughout history and through in our lives as well. But we struggle with that. We're so faced with our current situations that we don't often get to step away and look from the perspective of God, which is this perspective of eternity. And I must just remind us of Isaiah 55, verse 9. You can put it on. It's just this reality that, for as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways and my thoughts than your thoughts. It's this problem that we have is that we try to be instructors to God. We think that we are wise. We think that we can tell him this is how you ought to act. This is how you ought to be doing things, because clearly this is the right thing and the best thing to happen and that should be done. But he is saying that, listen, there's a bigger picture that you don't see. There is something that I'm busy doing here that you don't appreciate right now. But in eternity, one day when you're standing with me from eternity, you will understand, you will see. But for now, you just need to trust me. And that's the challenge that I want to leave all of us today, is that in every situation that you face, that you would get this refrain in your heart, God, I trust you. I maybe don't understand what's going on. I don't understand you, and probably I'm not able to understand you. It's like a parent trying to tell his child, listen, this thing is bad for you, you shouldn't be doing this. You can try to explain it, but they don't get it. Like, I don't get to do the thing that I want to do. That's all that they understand. So it's like, why can't I have 20 hours of screen time a day? I mean, like, what's wrong with that? It's like, it's hard to explain to a child. And it's similar for us, between us and God. God really can try to explain, but we are just incapable of understanding a lot of the time because his ways are higher. So when you have this nagging in your heart, it's like, okay, why is this happening? Turn this feeling into this refrain, God, I trust you. 5 minutes later, okay, it's still hurting, Lord. I still don't understand, but I trust you. It's like I'm casting all of my cares and all of my anxieties on you, Lord, because I trust you. Things may not look in my life the way I thought they were going to look at this stage. Things are not working out the way I thought it was going to work out. But in eternity, Lord, I trust that this picture will change, and I trust that from that perspective, everything will make sense. Lord, I trust you that you are painting a bigger picture and that your faithfulness in my life cannot just be viewed through this current situation I'm in, but it should be viewed through the perspective that you have. You are faithful. Lord, I trust you. And while we may not understand God, while his ways might be bigger than ours or higher than ours, we can trust that he is working everything towards his perfect plan and that nothing can stop him from accomplishing what he intends. This is important. He is good, and nothing can stop him from what he intends to accomplish. So there is no situation that you're facing that is beyond his ability to have an impact on. Now, I just want to step to the side a bit just to help us understand this bigger picture that God is busy with in the world. And then I'm going to jump into a single example. So God's big plan that he has had since before the foundation of the world is that he is going to create people. These people are going to like somehow mess up. He's going to send a savior, Jesus. He's going to in that way reconcile all men to himself and then enter into relationship with them fully so that they can spend eternity with him. That has been his plan all along. So in Revelation 13 verse 8 it says, the Lamb was slain from the foundation of the world. Jesus was crucified from the foundation of the world. In 1 Peter 1 verse 19, it says, it was the precious blood of Christ, the sinless, spotless Lamb of God. You can go next verse. And God chose him, that's Jesus, as your ransom long before the world began. But he has now revealed him to you in these last days. So Jesus was our ransom. He was intended to be crucified before the world even began. Okay, now just think about that for a moment. It's kind of a shocking realization when you realize that the cross was not the response to man's sin. It wasn't like oh shucks, Adam and Eve messed up now. Now we need to come up with some plan or some solution here. It's like before God even created Adam and Eve, he already knew how things are going to play out. And Jesus was already at creation. As he's creating Adam and Eve, he already knows one day in the future, I will have to come down to earth, become a man, and give up my life for these people. It was in his mind, in his perspective from the beginning. We see this also in Isaiah 46:10, where it says he declares the end from the beginning. He's outside of time. He sees everything. And not just that he is outside of time and just like viewing everything. He has direct impact and influence on everything over the entire timeline so that there is no one that can thwart his plan that will end up in eternity where everything is ultimately culminating in this victorious togetherness that we are heading towards. Now, why God did the things the way he did and why the fall had to happen, all of these things, I think it's a pretty big topic and it's a topic for another sermon. I'm not going to try to unpack that now. But I want us to just look at the story of Joseph because he's such a good example of just where God's sovereignty is at play in that story. And what I want to kind of embed in all of us is that it's not the story of Joseph. That's not why it was written down. It's not so that we learn more about Joseph. The Bible is written down so that we can learn more about God and how he relates to people. It's just an example of, you see how God worked in Joseph's life? That's the same way he might work in your life. It's the same God. It's the same character, same nature that he has. So, yeah, let's just go through the story of Joseph and then I'll just unpack it a little bit. So, Joseph is the son of Jacob, who is the son of Isaac, who is the son of Abraham. So, Abraham, this person that God gave the promise that your descendants will be as numerous as the stars and as the sand, he has now descendants. And his descendants is going through Isaac to Jacob, and now Jacob has 12 sons. One of these sons is Joseph. And Joseph was Jacob's favorite son. He was definitely not being fair. The reason why he was his favorite son is because he was the oldest son of his beloved wife, Rachel. And Rachel couldn't have children, so there were lots of other children with Leah and lots of other, concubines, thank you. But ultimately, Rachel had a child, Joseph, and he loved him more than all the other brothers. He gave him this special coat, this tunic that was multicolored and made his brothers even more jealous. And then God, at some point, gave Joseph two dreams that very directly implied that his brothers and his parents are going to bow down before him. And you can imagine a little teenager, prideful teenager, sharing these dreams. So his brothers hated him even more. And then ultimately, they just wanted to kill him. So at some point in the future, then Jacob sent Joseph to just go look up on his brothers. It's a brilliant idea. These guys that want to kill him, let's go send you by yourself and go look up on them. But anyways, their brothers, as they see him coming on, they plot to kill him. So they take Joseph, they throw him in a pit. Reuben, the oldest brother, he wants to go free Joseph, but just at the right time, he's out of the picture. And then Judah then has this idea, okay, let's, instead of killing him, there's some Ishmaelite traders, some slave traders. They're coming along here. If we kill him, we get nothing. If we sell him, we at least get some money. So that's a good idea. Okay, let's get Joseph out. Let's sell him to these slave traders. Okay, now they have to make up a story. So they tell their father, Jacob, that Joseph was killed by some wild animal. Jacob is obviously super sad about all of this. We'll get back to Jacob a little bit later. Joseph is now taken to Egypt. He's sold as a slave to Potiphar's house. Potiphar is the captain of the guard, so he's close to the Pharaoh. So Joseph grows up in this context of the Pharaoh and the palace. God gives him favor, and he rises up in this household till he manages everything in Potiphar's household. But then Potiphar's wife starts to take a liking in Joseph, and then she tries to seduce him, and he just stands strong. He just doesn't let him be swayed by her. And ultimately, she tries to forcibly sleep with him. And as he's running away, then she grabs his coat. And he's away, but now she is now got his coat. And she's upset that this guy didn't want to fall for her. Because, I'm sure that she also grew up in getting whatever she wanted. But now she couldn't get Joseph. Then she blames Joseph. Then she speaks to her husband Potiphar and says, Joseph, he tried to sleep with me. And then Potiphar is super angry with Joseph, so he then throws Joseph in the prison. So there Joseph goes even lower down. Now in the prison, similar, God gives him favor and he rises up in the ranks of the prison until he ultimately manages the entire prison. Sometime later, the Pharaoh's cupbearer and baker are thrown also into the prison under Joseph's care. And for some reason, they both have a dream on the same night. The baker's dream, let's just say it like this, Joseph ultimately is the only one that could interpret these dreams. And the baker's dream was interpreted to mean that he's going to be hanged in a few days, in 3 days. And the cupbearer's dream was saying that, yeah, he's going to be taken out of prison and restored to his position in 3 days. So this happens, and then as the cupbearer is released, Joseph says, please remember me. I mean, like, I'd shown you some kindness. Please remember me when you're with Pharaoh. I'm here innocently. Just put a good word in for me. But the cupbearer, I don't know, maybe he was afraid. He was just thrown into prison. Like, I would also be a bit afraid to just suddenly step out of my bounds and try to speak up for someone. So the Bible just says he forgot about Joseph. Anyways, two full years passed, and Joseph is still stuck in prison. By this stage, Joseph has been a slave for 13 years. And then the Pharaoh has two dreams in the same night, and he's freaked out by these dreams. He doesn't know what to do with them. So he calls everyone around him to try to interpret these dreams for him, but nobody can do it. Nobody has a clue what it means. And finally, the cupbearer takes up the confidence to say, but Pharaoh, I know this guy in prison. I think he can help you. So they call Joseph out of prison. Joseph interprets these dreams with the help of God, and the dreams is interpreted to mean that there's going to be 7 years of abundance, there's going to be more than enough, and then 7 years of famine where there's going to be nothing. So Joseph says, Pharaoh, I think you should appoint someone that's wise to manage these affairs for you so that you can gather enough in the 7 years so that you've got enough left over for the years of famine. And then Pharaoh says, I think I found the guy. You're the guy. You are going to be the one that manages this for me. And he raises him up from an instant, from being a slave in prison to being the highest position in Egypt, equal to the Pharaoh. So then after the 7 years of abundance, a famine comes. But the famine doesn't only hit Egypt, it also hits Canaan, where Jacob and his family, Joseph's brothers and family, is still living. So they need food. They send the brothers to Egypt to come fetch food. They bow before Joseph, don't know who he is. I'm going to skip over a lot of parts there, but ultimately, Joseph reveals to them who he is, that he is their brother who they sold. And then suddenly they become afraid. They're like, oh shucks, like we messed up badly here, and now this super powerful brother of ours is going to kill us. So just going to read here Genesis 45. So it says, and now do not be distressed or angry with yourselves because you sold me here. For God sent me before you to preserve life. Just stand still there. Who sent Joseph? I thought it was his brothers that sold him. I thought it was his brothers that just wanted to kill him. It's like, no, God sent me there. Why did he send? To preserve life. Okay, next verse. It says, for the famine has been in the land these 2 years, and there are yet 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvest. And God sent me before you to preserve for you a remnant on the earth, and to keep alive for you many survivors. So it was not you who sent me here, but God. He has made me a father to Pharaoh and lord of all his house and ruler over all the land of Egypt. So what happens now is that, okay, there's some reconciliation. The family comes, Jacob, and everyone comes. Jacob is obviously overjoyed to hear that Joseph is alive. And now they're living in the land of Goshen, good land in Egypt, and eventually, obviously, Jacob dies. And now his brothers again freak out, and they're like, okay, well, Joseph was just keeping us alive for the sake of Jacob, but now that Jacob is dead, now he's actually finally going to get us. And then in Genesis 50, Joseph says, do not fear, for am I in the place of God? As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it, the same thing, for good. So it was good that he was in prison and like everything, he was suffering for 13 years. God meant it for good, to bring it about that many people should be kept alive as they are today. Now, I don't think Joseph came to these insights while he was in prison and while he was constantly being pushed lower and lower. I think he was like, God, what are you doing? I thought you are the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. What is going on here? I am a descendant of Jacob. Why are you not looking out for me? I think those were things that he was wrestling with, as we would all be wrestling with. But it was like they always say, hindsight is 20/20. Like when you look back and you look when he looked at his life, he's like, this is no coincidence. Every instant of my life, God was there directing, controlling, making sure that I get to where I'm at so that ultimately there's this food that we can give to the family and everybody can be kept alive. So it's often for us similar. We don't see God's hand working in our lives when we are in the situation that we are facing. It is almost always only after, and sometimes only in eternity, that we will see why things were happening. Why did we have to go through this? What was God busy doing? Okay, so now I'm going to go through the same story again, and I'm going to try to just highlight this sovereignty of God. Like, what was he busy? What do I think, as being a feeble human being, trying to understand the mind of God? What was God thinking in doing all of these things? So this is my attempt. Just take it as that. So let's take one step back. What is God busy trying to do? He's painting a bigger picture here. Ultimately, he has decided that through the line of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, there's going to be a line from which Jesus is going to be born. Okay, so this line, the line through the Israelites, need to be preserved. They need to be kept alive. So there's the land where they're currently living in Canaan is going to be struck by a famine in a couple of decades. So in a couple of decades, I need to have something in place so that I can preserve them alive, because otherwise they would probably all die. And so God plans to save them, but he also decides to do this in a way that makes sure that he will only be the one that receives the glory. It's not just that Pharaoh is this amazing king and then is so generous and gives to the Israelites, to Jacob and the family. It's like, no, God is doing it in such a way that he ultimately gets the glory. Now, there's a second part that God is busy doing, and I don't want to make this too complicated, but God is busy painting this prophetic picture of how salvation is going to look. For this picture to work, he needs the nation of Israel to be in Egypt so that they can be enslaved in Egypt. And as they are slaves in Egypt, as we are slaves to sin, he then sets them free by Moses leading them out as Jesus leads us out of sin, gives us freedom. And then just as they had to go through the Red Sea, we are entering through baptism to associate with Jesus, but then also into the newness of life. And then ultimately he's leading them to the promised land again, where the land is overflowing with milk and honey. And that is us heading ultimately to eternity with God. So he's busy painting this prophetic picture of what he is doing in the world. And for this picture to work, he needs the nation of Israel to move from Canaan to Egypt. How is he going to get the entire nation of Israel, Jacob and all of the family, to Egypt? Well, let's send Joseph there and then ultimately make sure that everybody needs to follow him because there's food there. So he's busy painting this bigger picture. So it's not that just that God wanted to save and preserve life. He also was painting a vivid prophetic picture, just because, I don't know, maybe a little bit facetious here, but it's almost like he can't help himself to reveal what he wants to do in the world. He's just so excited about what Jesus is going to do that throughout the nation of Israel, he is constantly painting these prophetic pictures. Okay, so how is he going to achieve all of this? Well, he's going to find an immature teenager and who's probably a bit prideful and give him two dreams. Just two dreams for good measure. Like, one dream would have been enough, but two dreams for good measure, so that when he shares it with his brothers will absolutely despise this guy and want to kill him. Okay, so then he secondarily makes sure that while his brothers are far away, Jacob has this strange idea to send Joseph as a lamb to the slaughter to look up on his brothers, and then they throw him into the pit, and then Reuben, the guy that wanted to save him, God makes sure he's just out of the picture for a moment while he sends the Ishmaelite traders past. So the Judah then has this idea to sell Joseph to these traders. And what's even more interesting is God again nudges a little prophetic picture in here, because Joseph was sold for 20 pieces of silver, which was the slave's price in his day. And then later, Jesus would be betrayed for 30 pieces of silver, which was the slave's price in his day. So he's just kind of like sprinkling in these little things in there. And then ultimately, Jacob ends up in Egypt, and the thing is, Jacob is still kind of, he's a kid at this stage, so he's still quite immature. God needs to board some character into this guy. He also needs to board him with this managerial ability so that he can ultimately manage the entire nation of Egypt. I'm like, that's not a small feat. So how does God do this? He puts him close to the Pharaoh's house, the captain of the guard. So Jacob learns the language, he learns the culture, he learns the etiquette, he learns everything that he needs to learn, how to function in this society, in this palace. He also learns some management, he also learns character. Potiphar's wife is on his case, he's growing in character, learning to trust God more. Then ultimately, okay, now he's getting to a good place here. God decides, okay, I'm just going to humble you a little bit more, just need to build some more character in you. But I'm also not going to give you an entire prison to manage. There's a little bit more responsibility, more challenging situations. It's not this nice palace household, it is the rough of the rough that you now need to find out how to manage here. So
He boards him up there. And then, at the same time, the baker and the cupbearer gets thrown into prison with Joseph. And if you think about it, there was no need for them to get dreams at all. Whether they got dreams or not, the fate, the outcome would have been the same. The one would have been saved, the other one would have been hanged. That would have happened regardless. But God wants to get Joseph a fast track to Pharaoh, so he takes the guy that's closest to Pharaoh, the cupbearer, and he gives him a dream that he gives Joseph the ability to interpret so that he has this inside track sometime down the line. Then 2 years later, Pharaoh has two dreams. I'm like, God just interrupts Pharaoh's life. Pharaoh has no control over his sleep. God just comes and he decides he's going to guide the king's heart in his dreams. He's got no resistance. He puts two dreams in the king's heart, in Pharaoh's heart, in his mind, and he makes sure that nobody has any clue what this means. If cupbearer remembers Joseph, he then raises up, he then calls Joseph up. Joseph interprets these dreams, and then he's in an instant raised up from the lowest to the highest position in Egypt. And you know the rest of the story. Ultimately, the whole family moves to Egypt. Several hundred years later, they're being enslaved in Egypt because the people forgot Joseph, the new Pharaoh forgot Joseph. And then ultimately Moses came and then set the people free. And everything that I just said was guided and woven together by this sovereign hand of God. So when you think about your life, one day you will stand where Joseph is, and the confusion will fall away, and you will say, now I see, now I understand. God has been boarding this thing in me this whole time. He was boarding character in me this whole time. He was boarding perseverance. He was boarding trust in me this whole time. So I want to leave you again with this question. How would you describe God? How big is your God? Can your God give you a dream just to humble you in the next moment? Can your God direct decisions? Can he harden and soften hearts? Can he influence others' thoughts? Can he restrain evil decisions and cause certain decisions? Is he powerful enough to have any influence in anything that he wants to achieve in your life? Can he do that? Because if he can, and he's busy painting this bigger picture, then we can trust him, because he is faithful. I've got this testimony of his faithfulness. Many of you who have walked with him for some time has this testimony of his faithfulness. Let's trust him. So surrender your story to the Lord again, like Joseph's story. Surrender your story to the Lord, that he be the writer of it. Remain faithful in every season. Don't become moping when you're thrown into prison. Remain faithful to God. And believe that God is ultimately sovereignly working together all things for his good and his glorious purposes. So trust him.